Puerto Ricans and their great reconstruction. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Almost 15 months after the devastation of Hurricane Maria, thousands of Puerto Ricans are still trying to rebuild their homes, their communities, and their lives. Billions of dollars are expected from the feds, but how will the territory's government make sure that money is going to help the people on the island and not get back to the mainland? Also, it's hard to know how many Americans are struggling with eating disorders, in part because of the stigma that surrounds an unhealthy relationship with food. We're hosting a panel discussion on the issue. We're going to learn more about how to define eating disorders, the types of treatments available, and how insurance plays a role. And finally, the stage show House on Fire tackles the idea of lies, and it's making its world debut at Palm Beach Drama Works. We'll get a sneak peek from two of the performers. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. It will be 15 months this week when Hurricane Maria pounded the territory of Puerto Rico as a Category 4 storm. That storm left a wake of devastation, death, and a lot of questions about the future of the island. In 15 months, exactly how much has changed? What's improved? We're joined now by NPR reporter Adrian Florido, who has been on the island now for a year reporting on all that's happened and the struggles that continue. Adrian, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
No, thank you, Luis.
You know what? I mean, you've been there a year, and so you've had the chance to see the change. You've had the chance to see a lot of places that struggle to change to improve. But how would you describe to anyone really what's happened in the last 12, 13, 14 months?
Well, I mean, there has been a significant amount of progress in the reconstruction. Slow progress, but there has been progress. But there are still a lot of places that need a lot of work still. And so, you know, the things that were the immediate emergency after the hurricane, like, you know, the blackout and the fact that many people didn't have water and that a lot of people didn't have food, those situations have generally been resolved. But there are still a lot of people who don't have roofs over their heads, who are still living in houses covered by those iconic blue tarps. There are a lot of sort of public sort of facilities and a lot of infrastructure and streets and roads that are still damaged that haven't been repaired. And then there's still a lot of emotional trauma. You know, people trying to move on, but unable to because the reminders of the hurricane are everywhere.
And one of the things that was so surprising, you had reported on this back in October, was that the island, the government doesn't have a plan if another hurricane like this came through. And I mean, hurricane season's over, so at least, you know, we got lucky. But I mean, do they have anything close to a plan? Are they talking about it?
So, you know, the government announced earlier this year that it had finished its hurricane and disaster response plan. And what happened was that it was very proudly announced that it was done. It said, well, you know, we are ready for the next storm should another one come the size of Hurricane Maria. And then journalists requested the plan, and the government refused to release it. And it was only through a lawsuit that the government came to, because the journalists sued the government, that the government's lawyers came to acknowledge in court that actually the plan was not complete. So there is this sort of general disaster response plan that it had completed, but the sections of the plan that were for specific types of disasters, including for hurricanes, hadn't even been done. And so, you know, it raised a lot of questions about how prepared the island really was if its plan for how to respond to a hurricane hadn't even been, you know, that plan hadn't even been contracted out. They hadn't even begun working on it.
Puerto Rico's government is expecting federal help from D.C., but it has they haven't gotten a lot of it yet. But what do you have any answers as to why? Why has it taken so long?
So, I mean, they're all, you know, the money coming in from the federal government is from all kinds of different sources. And so there is a lot of money. There are billions that have already been spent, you know, attending to the immediate emergency. And a lot of that came through FEMA. So things like, you know, paying for things like the blue tarps and all the food distribution in the early days, paying for the reconstruction, sorry, the repairs to the power grid. And now they're sort of, we're entering a phase in the recovery where it's sort of these dollars are coming in for longer term reconstruction. So to improve infrastructure, so that it's stronger and not just, in the same condition as it was before the hurricane. So some of that money is coming in through FEMA. The Puerto Rican government is in a sort of a fight with FEMA because it says, the government says that part of the reason that this is taking so long, this reconstruction, is because in a lot of states, when you have a disaster, a lot of times those states are just empowered to spend FEMA's money. But in this case, the Puerto Rican government has to spend the money first and then request reimbursement. So that's sort of an issue. Another sort of funding coming in is from the Federal Housing and Urban Development, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD. $20 billion are on the way. They're just the first sort of installment of $1.5 billion is just beginning to flow. And the idea there is that it's going to pay for a lot of the things that FEMA and other federal funding sources wouldn't be able to pay for. So repairs to a lot of roofs that are still damaged, but whose owners, didn't qualify for FEMA assistance, that sort of thing.
And we talk about reconstruction, and something fascinating is that obviously now there's going to be a need for a lot of work to be done on the island, and contractors obviously are swarming to the island. You were at, I think it was a conference or some kind of event recently, I think hosted by the Puerto Rican government, where basically they're inviting Puerto Ricans to come out and say they're going to be construction jobs, good paying construction jobs, and we can help train you and prepare you. Am I correct on that? Is that what the event was?
Yeah, so once this federal f funding starts to flow, there are going to be a lot of contractors here doing a lot of reconstruction work. And so what the government of Puerto Rico says is that it's going to need 100,000 new workers essentially to enter the labor market to do especially construction work. And so this this 2-day training that it held at the convention center in San Juan. The same place, by the way, that had been the site of the joint sort of operational response center after the hurricane. So that the government put on this 2-day training last week for people who want to get into the construction industry, who want to learn to be construction workers. And I met a lot of people there who said, "Look, the hurricane was a bad thing, but it destroyed so much, and there's going to be so much work rebuilding that this could be a solid 2 years of work for me." And the governor signed an order recently requiring that contractors that do get these contracts, requiring that they pay $15 minimum wage for contractor sorry for construction workers, which is a lot more than people have made here doing that kind of work in the past.
We're talking again with NPR reporter Adrian Florido. He is in San Juan, Puerto Rico. He's been there now in Puerto Rico for a year. Covering the aftermath of Hurricane Maria, the reconstruction of the island, of the territory. There was a story you had in the last couple of months, a powerful story, very disturbing, but also something that shows, really the frustration Puerto Ricans have had in this reconstruction, in these reconstruction efforts. And it's about a cemetery in Lares, and the storm damaged the cemetery and created a mudslide and actually destroyed some of the tombs, and even some of the caskets had come out, and people are not allowed in there, even though they're desperate to get in to see what's happened to the remains of their loved ones. But real quickly, what's going on with that right now? It's still closed, right?
It is still closed. I mean, this is a story that's sort of a reminder of how, even though things have gotten better in a lot of places, there are a lot of places, other places where things look like they looked just after the storm, and the cemetery is one of those places. People have not been allowed in the 15 months since the hurricane, and people are getting angry, and they're getting frustrated, and they are demanding that the officials make repairs, because they're trying to move on emotionally, after the hurricane. But it's one of these reminders that, hey, your family's tomb is possibly destroyed, and I don't even know if the casket is still in the grave, and how can I move on emotionally if that's the case.
You've been there now, as I said, a year, and you've had the chance to talk to a lot of different people on the island, and I just wondered your take. I know it's everybody's different, but I just wondered, do you get the sense Puerto Ricans are optimistic about their future, or are they doubtful about, the process of trying to rebuild their lives?
You know, it's hard to sort of make general statements about how people feel, because a lot of it depends on how much they've been able to rebuild. In a lot of wealthy communities and middle class communities, people have made a lot more progress than they have in lower income and working class communities. You know, overall, you know, everyone has made hope at least some kind of progress, but again, some places have made much more progress than others. I think people are, you know, there's a sense of mistrust of the government at all levels here, right? Because we saw how sort of bungled the federal response was, and how completely unprepared Puerto Rico's government was to respond to something like this. And so there's a lot of sort of doubts when, you know, the government comes out and says, okay, things are getting better, we're prepared the next time. And so, you know, generally, there's a pessimism around how well prepared the government is. But there's also at the same time a sense of, well, you know, if the government isn't going to sort of do what it's got to do, then, you know, we have to sort of be prepared ourselves. And so at that conference we were talking about earlier, I met a guy who went not because he wanted to get work as a construction worker. He went because he said, look, in my community, Loíza, which is not far from the capital, he said people, after the storm, started rebuilding their own homes because we couldn't wait for the government. And we're still working on that rebuilding. And so the reason I came was not because I'm looking for a job as a construction worker. I came because I just want to learn how the building codes work. And I want to see if there's anything I can learn about how we can rebuild our houses stronger, so I can take that information back to my community and tell people, hey, look, you know, you rebuilt your roof this way, but actually if you just did these couple of adjustments, it actually would make it a lot stronger. And this sort of like, let's just do it ourselves sort of mentality you hear and see across the island, not because people want that to be the case, but because often people feel like they don't have any other option.
Again, we've been talking with NPR reporter Adrian Florido. He is in San Juan, Puerto Rico. He's been in Puerto Rico for a year now, reporting on the reconstruction of the island. And if you haven't had the chance, we're going to post it up on our Twitter. Please check out his story. Some fascinating reporting and a great look at really how the people of the island have been fighting to get their lives back into order, get their lives back to some kind of normalcy 15 months later. Adrian, it's been such a pleasure, man. I really appreciate it. And we'll have to have you back on, get more updates.
Absolutely. Thanks, Liz.
Appreciate it again. And I just wanted to note, as we're going out, you're listening to Herman Olivada and Yova Rodriguez. Borinquen se levanta. So much beautiful music coming out now of Puerto Ricans fighting to get themselves back. Well, still to come, millions of Americans struggle with eating disorders. What's the best way to tackle this often difficult topic? That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Thanks again for joining us. Well, eating disorders affect millions of Americans every day. Binge eating, anorexia, bulimia, and emotional overeating are impacting more and more of the population. And today we're going to have a panel discussion with three experts who work directly in the field of treatment. Dr. Lewis Jones is the site director for the West Palm Beach Renfrew Center. For more than 30 years, the nationwide center has treated tens of thousands of women with eating disorders. Dr. Jones joins us from the studios of WXEL in West Palm Beach. Dr. Jones, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Also joining us here in the studios in downtown Miami is Dr. Autumn Ning. She's an assistant professor of psychodynamic psychiatry at FIU, who's worked one-on-one with eating disorder clients. Dr. Ning, such a pleasure. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you.
And also joining us is Arlene B. Englander, a psychotherapist with a private practice in North Palm Beach. She's a former emotional overeater herself. And she's the author of a book called Let Go of Emotional Overeating and Love Your Food, a 5-point plan for success, published by Roman and Littlefield this year. Ms. Englander, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
Thanks for having me and for doing this.
All right. And it is an important topic to discuss, because as we go into the holidays, of course, you know, food becomes a big part of our lives, and that could be even more difficult for a lot of people. By the way, if this is an issue that you or someone in your family is struggling with and you have a question, maybe it's something about where to find the right treatment. What is the right treatment? How do you find the right kind of doctor or therapist? And, of course, insurance questions. Give us a call, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. Dr. Ning, let me start with you. Let's just begin by understanding the pervasiveness of eating disorders in the culture. you know, do you have a sense of the scope of the problem? Because, I mean, I say millions of Americans, really trying to nail down a number has been kind of tough.
It is hard. I mean, nowadays, what we know is just that for eating disorders, for it to be defined as an eating disorder per DSM, per the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the number is probably from 0.5 to 1%. It could be pretty high, but we also know that there's a huge spectrum of people with eating issues that don't necessarily reach the criteria of eating disorders that are still very problematic and affect functionality.
The things that I mentioned, those are eating disorders.
Yes.
So how do you, then what are eating issues? How would you define that?
So that could be emotional overeating. It could be people who yo-yo between binging and dieting. It could be people who never quite reach criteria for something like anorexia. Maybe they haven't lost enough weight to satisfy that criteria, but they're on their way. So those are still things that we would want to address.
Dr. Jones, how does this affect people from different backgrounds? What are you looking at? Is it because you deal with a lot, you work with women? I mean, men, women, how do they differ in the way they handle this issue? What about people from different ethnic mm-hmm. backgrounds, things like that?
Yeah, there can be so many different presentations of eating disorders. And, of course, family, culture, individual experience can have an impact on that. So the presentations can vary widely. So you really have to take the whole person into account. So doing a very thorough assessment in the initial interview is always very important.
And what are the long-term effects of eating disorders that you've seen, especially if they go untreated?
Oh, they can be devastating. Eating disorders can be the most deadly diagnosis that we look at. And so we really have to take these as seriously as possible. So having discussions like these just help raise awareness so people can check in, potentially find resources, and get help. So we have seen at the Renfrew Center, we go into residential levels of care where people have to be on feeding tubes, where they know they need to eat, but just simply can't make that choice because of the underlying emotion that drives some of their behavior. So without adequate assessment and treatment, these can end up being deadly.
Arlene B. Englander, you've dealt with your own issue of overeating. I mean, when did you, by the way, come to that point where you understood what was going on?
It's true that I have a unique perspective on the issue of eating disorders, and one of the reasons I'm so passionate about helping others get past them and recover is very possibly because I have experienced it myself. Not only am I a Columbia University-trained psychotherapist and someone who's developed health promotion programs, but I was actually myself the administrator of a psychiatric hospital with a well-known eating disorders unit when I realized that I myself had had these issues for a number of years. In my adolescence and in college, I would eat for 3 days and pretty much eat everything in sight for 3 days. Then I would fast for 3 days, probably only smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee or eating Diet Coke. Then in my early adulthood, I yo-yo dieted, obsessing about whatever I ate or didn't eat, and really losing a great deal of pleasure and productivity, you know, during that period. So it's really wonderful to be on the other side of that and have a healthy relationship with food, which I can share with my clients as well as whenever appropriate the personal experiences that I had.
And real quickly, I mean, at what point did you finally say, this is an issue, I've got to do something about it? At what stage of your life were you in at that point?
Well, at that point, I was already a trained psychotherapist and an administrator. When I first experienced mindful eating at the facility at which I worked, I realized that there was another way to live, that it was possible to eat what one liked, savor it slowly, and stop just at the point of satisfaction without overeating. So it brings me a great deal of pleasure to be able to share that with clients.
Again, the number is 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. It is a difficult topic to discuss, but if you have a question, I mean, whether it's about you or someone you know, if you think that there is an eating disorder that you or someone you know is struggling with, or maybe it's just, you know, you have questions about where to even begin to look for treatment. How do you find the right treatment? You know, give us a call, 800-743-9576. You can also, if you want to, you can post your question on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. And of course, I'll read some of those here today for our guests. Dr. Ning, let's something she said interesting, yo-yo dieting, dieting in general, because this is a culture of dieting and it's there's diet books everywhere and everybody's always trying to sell me a diet program or something. But I mean, what should we understand about dieting, and does dieting, like yo-yo dieting, kind of lead to all of these problems?
I like to understand dieting as a particular behavior, but the question for us is what is driving that behavior? Is it something about how we look that we're not satisfied with? Is it something about our health, right? If somebody who has, for example, diabetes wants to be on a diet, that may be a good thing for that individual given their own circumstances. If there's somebody else who may be, you know, in good health but decides to go on a particular diet for a particular reason, then that reason deserves to be understood. So a lot of it depends on what is driving that behavior of dieting.
Help me understand, and I'm wondering, you know, if you could speak to how you treat eating disorders. I mean, how do your recommendations vary depending on who's coming in? When somebody comes in, what is it you're looking for right away?
It's a good question, and Dr. Jones spoke to some of that. It's really important that we understand why the individual is coming and what they understand of themselves. We always want to be able to assess how close to danger is this person? Are they unhealthy to the level where they need to be admitted to a place of where they can get actual medical treatment, or are they in a place where they can actually adjust their behavior? You want to be able to assess where they are psychologically as well as physically, biologically, medically, and to make sure that they're safe.
Dr. Jones, chime in on that. I mean, if somebody comes in, what's the process? Am I doing an interview with you? Am I filling out a form? I mean, how are you getting to that information about me and how you could help me?
Yeah, we want to make access as easy as possible to start. So it starts with a phone call or going online, and then it does start with an interview, a diagnostic full biopsychosocial interview. As I said, we want to get to know the whole person, the influences, as well as the levels of the particular eating disorder. And so, yeah, they talk to us. We make recommendations for level of care. We can explore insurance options and really try and work with that client to access the level of care that they need.
Arlene, what kind of people, I mean, who's coming to you for help? What kind of people are you working with? What kind of issues are you helping people deal with?
When I'm working with emotional overeaters, which is a large segment of the population with which I treat, very often there are people who realize that they could enjoy food and life more, that they're spending an inordinate amount of time obsessing about what they eat or what they don't eat, and they aren't feeling as good about their lives, their health, and their activities in general. So it's really a matter of helping them learn how to handle stress effectively away from the table, how to enjoy life more fully, handle stress.
But are these people who have, I mean, we're talking about people who are dealing with anorexia, bulimia, I don't want to say it because I don't know. I mean, are these the serious issues? Or, I mean, is it just people who are, again, struggling to have a healthy relationship with food?
At this point in my career, after over 20 years of practice, I am generally working more often with emotional overeaters. That is something I do relate to both professionally and personally. And emotional overeating, unfortunately, is a tremendously pervasive issue in our society today. And many people, just as myself, are not even initially aware that it is an issue and that their lives could be so much more pleasurable and productive if they got past it. As I define emotional overeating, it is eating neither for enjoyment nor for the satisfaction of hunger, but in a desperate attempt to distract ourselves from painful thoughts and feelings.
And this goes to where all of this comes from. But, you know, what Dr. Jones, I mean, she talked about, you know, again, the emotional connection. And I'm wondering if, you know, in treating eating disorders, is it purely an emotional issue, or is it biological, physiological, genetics? What is it? Where is it coming from?
Well, I'd say the simple answer is yes.
Okay.
but at the Renfrew Center, we are really looking at an eating disorder as an underlying emotionally based disorder. Because what's driving the eating disorder behavior is typically difficult emotion that people don't want to feel. And they find these behaviors that help them avoid or escape a feeling. So we've developed this transdiagnostic model that we try and treat all the different eating disorders from the perspective that it's an underlying emotional issue driving it. And that way, not only can you treat the varying eating disorders, but you can also help people make progress with some of the co-occurring disorders, whether that be an anxiety disorder, trauma, depression, things like that. So the emotion that's underneath it is very important.
Dr. Ning, I mean, yeah, I come back to when you meet up with a potential client, patient, you know, what is it you're trying to get at? Do you have to go deep into their past to figure out where something's coming from?
Definitely not on the first day.
Okay, well, no, that is a lot. That's true.
But we do like to be able to understand what these emotions are from. Sometimes they are from the past and we kind of carry them forward. And sometimes they are largely situational, but a lot of it depends on what we understand of what the eating disorder means to them, what it means to actually do these behaviors. People, for example, who suffer from trauma may have a particular feeling about food, about taking things inside themselves, about ingesting, about being bigger, about hiding within their skin. So a lot of what we do with food is very much symbolized. Food is very complicated to talk about. It's like talking about money.
Why? Wait a minute. Why is that? Why is food tough to talk about?
If we think about food, and this is where some of it differs from, say, speaking about addiction, we can live without alcohol, we can live without cocaine, we can live without cigarettes, but we really cannot live without food. So we have to find a way to deal with that. And our first even social interactions are around food. From the day one that we're brought into life, we have an interaction with another human being that involves food. Someone has to feed us. We can't feed ourselves when we're born, right? So right there, we have an attachment to someone around the idea of food. And hopefully for most of us, that attachment is a good one. It is warm. It makes us feel safe and secure. So most of us have a positive feeling about food going into life, we hope.
Arlene, do you get that sense that a lot of people just do not have a good relationship with food? There's some negative attachment, a negative emotion attached to it?
Unfortunately, that can often be the case, and especially in a society that tends to label foods as sometimes forbidden and good or bad, putting good or bad labels on food. Very often people will crave foods that they feel they should not eat, as opposed to learning to really relax and be comfortable with themselves and to do as most evolved nutritionists today suggest, which is to follow more of a 90-10 or 80-20 model, which is 80-90% healthy foods and 10 to 20% fun foods. So when all foods are allowable, we find that we can really sit and savor, for example, that very small and luscious piece of Godiva chocolate for 5 minutes and then not think about chocolate for a week. So it's really a matter of learning how to slowly savor and enjoy whatever we like, but also make peace with healthy stress management, healthy relating, and loving food more.
Again, we're talking about the issue of eating disorders, and it is a difficult topic to discuss, but one that's really important because it affects so many people. And as we've been hearing from our panel, it is a wide range of issues. It could be very serious to life-threatening to, you know, maybe just the way that we are in relationship with food and how it may link to some moment in our lives. But all of these things are things that we're trying to tackle. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. If you have a question, whether it's about how to diagnose it or whether it's to understand like best treatments, how to find the right person to help you, or if maybe you have a question about insurance and how does insurance chime in on this issue, we'd love to hear from you. 800-743-9576. Again, I'm talking with Dr. Autumn Ning, Assistant Professor of Psychodynamic Psychiatry at FIU. Also, Dr. Lewis Jones, the site director for the Renfrew Center in West Palm Beach, a treatment facility for those with eating disorders. And Arlene B. Englander, a licensed psychotherapist, also the author of the book Let Go of Emotional Overeating and Love Your Food, a 5-Point Plan for Success. You can also find us, by the way, on Twitter and Facebook at WLRN Sundial. You know what I wanted to get to just real quickly before we get to the phones? I wanted to ask about, how do you find the right person for help? I mean, where do you even begin? What would be a good place to start? Like, if I go online, like, I think I have an issue, who can help me on this? Or do I just start with my doctor? Dr. Jones, I'm going to start with you real quickly.
Sure. Yeah, I think it would be great to start with your doctor. Most people are really familiar with that process and can feel easier for them. So if that's what makes sense to that person, start there, and they can kind of medically assess, because so many of these issues have that medical safety issue. However, you can start with a therapist and assess fit, because that's really, really important in getting help. And along the way, between a therapist or a medical doctor, they can assess the level of care that's needed. So whether it's a simple outpatient, individual therapist once a week, or an intensive outpatient program, or all the way up to residential level of care. You can start with a phone call. You can call 1-800-RENFREW, and we'll have a free 2-hour assessment to help figure out what level of care is needed.
And Dr. Ning, what would you recommend to people? What should they be looking for or asking as they search for help?
I think the most important question, if they're looking for someone, say like an individual therapist, is how comfortable do they feel with these questions, talking with this person if it's an outpatient therapist, and do they feel ready for this? I think it's great to go to your doctor. As Dr. Jones suggests, I wouldn't disagree with anything that he said. And there are also national organizations that one can look at. Even if you just Google eating disorders, you will see the National Eating Disorder Association pop up, NIDA will pop up, EDA will pop up. And locally, in lots of major cities, we do have eating disorder treatment centers. And most of them, like Dr. Jones says, will offer you a free evaluation to see where you are and what level of care you might need.
And one of the issues, too, is the stigma with this. I mean, you know, yeah. Whether even going to a therapist, there's a lot of stigma. People are worried about how that could look for them if anybody found out. But, you know, what have you seen in like that? What's the stigma with even coming to grips with any reality of having an eating disorder and people wanting to talk about it or not?
You know, I would look at stigma even more broadly than that. Eating disorders is one of many things that get stigmatized for anybody who goes to see a therapist. I do think that that's turning a little bit. We have a lot more people coming to therapy more easily. We have wellness programs now, both corporately and in universities. So we're actually seeing much more openness about these kinds of issues. And I would think that that was one of the things that brought it to your attention in terms of even doing this show.
Yeah. Arlene, what about you? Is it tough to get past that with people to get them to open up and admit there's an issue and let's work on that relationship you have with food or with your challenge? Or do people still want to be quiet about it because it's not something you talk about?
When people have actually reached out and come to me, these are generally individuals who have a certain degree of self-awareness to begin with. What's wonderful about what you're doing today with a show like this is that you're helping so many others out there to become more aware and accepting. And I believe, as I would imagine my co-panelists do as well, that awareness is such a big part of moving past any behavior that is non-productive and harmful to our health.
In your own personal experience, did you deal with that stigma yourself? Were you worried about anybody knowing about any issues you may have been having?
Not exactly that I recall, but I'm just very glad that I have been in a field where I was able to become more aware myself of what I needed to do and how I needed to move forward, and that I have the wonderful opportunity of helping others move in the same direction myself. It's really very rewarding for me to help people come from a place where they were obsessing about food, they were not enjoying their lives, and finally to find a healthy relationship with food and to enjoy both food and life more.
Yeah. Dr. Jones, let me ask you about the issue of insurance. And is this something that is covered by your typical insurance plan, or, you know, is there any challenge that you that any of your patients face in trying to get this covered?
Yeah, well, yes. The broader, bigger insurance companies are learning that they need to be covering this. So the higher levels of care are definitely improving with their coverage. You know, it can be a challenge, you know, the difference between our clinical recommendations and what the insurance company is willing to pay for. But I'd say it is improving. I think the other issue you run into at lower levels of care and just an individual outpatient therapist is that, you know, it doesn't always make financial sense for an individual therapist to take insurance. And so you're finding the therapists that are really good aren't taking insurance just because it you know, you can't have a successful business just on insurance. So, yeah, at the lower levels, I think we're continuing to run into some issues with insurance. But I think overall, it is starting to trend in the right direction.
One other thing I wanted to get to as well is this issue of social media. And Dr. Jones, I want to start with you. You know, we live in the world where, you know, we're just constantly bombarded with images. We were always bombarded with images in the media of what beauty and perfection is. But now, it seems with social media, that's amplified. But you have a rule, actually, right? Is it that people, when they're going through treatment, they have to get off social media?
Yeah, we really are starting to incorporate a lot more of mindfulness into social media. And so at our facility, your phone's not allowed in treatment. You know, you check it at the front desk. But in our programming, yeah, we start to talk about cutting back on social media and recognizing the unrealistic, unfair expectations that are placed on all of us, but primarily on women, and how that can impact the underlying emotional engines of these eating disorders. So it's very important to increase awareness and educate, and bringing in mindfulness gives people this presence to be able to say, you know what, I don't like that image, and I'm not going to follow that person anymore.
Speaking of social media, we did get a question that came down through our Facebook page. Again, you can find us at WLRN Sundial. This one, anonymous. Question is, how would you suggest handling resistant patients, both those resistant to change and those labeled treatment resistant? Let me get everybody to chime in on that one. Dr. Ning.
Treatment resistant. There are patients who have a harder time coming to treatment and who have a harder time thinking about and dealing with the emotions that they have, that they've used these behaviors to help mitigate. And it takes, I think, a certain kind of therapist to be able to reach those people, and certain people with whom they interact. There's so much, you know, and thankfully, it's not been an issue for everyone, but especially around eating disorders, there is so much guilt and shame around some of these behaviors. Binging, purging. Often people will be binging and purging and say their spouses for 15 years will never know that they have been purging this whole time, right? So for these people to even come in to get treatment, they have to be met with an attitude of openness and acceptance for where they are without that stigma, without implying that there's something wrong with them, but that this is where they've gotten to for a reason.
And Arlene, you know, real quickly, I mean, when do you deal with that? Do you deal with that resistance from people that they don't want to change? And how do you get past that?
At first, when people come to speak to me about emotional overeating, they often have the sense that I'm going to tell them about a lot of things not to do. When in fact, what I try to do both in my work and in my writing is to teach people how to do things that are fun and enjoyable and will add to their life. For example, how to make exercise more fun, by trying something new, by trying a sport, by adding music, whatever they can do. Finding new healthy foods that they can enjoy eating along that 80-20, 90-10 ratio, and learning how to really savor their food and eat mindfully and be there in the moment. Most of what I recommend to clients involves enjoying life more, enjoying food more, and that really helps to break into the resistance that emotional overeaters often feel, because they expect that people are going to tell them about a lot of things that they should not do. And I find that that is counterproductive, because if it isn't pleasurable, it won't be permanent.
Which kind of goes back to the idea of dieting, which just tells us, restrict us on what we don't want to do, and then, of course, we don't succeed. Real quickly, as I close out here, Dr. Jones, I wanted to ask you, it's the holiday season, as I said, so it's about family and getting together with a lot of people, and a lot of food will be involved. But what do you say to folks who are struggling with issues like how to approach the holidays, because that could be a very stressful, painful time?
Absolutely. Whether it's the family or the food, the holidays are stressful. So we really encourage people, you know, more simply just to slow down, you know, in their own minds and in their bodies, and try and really zero in on what they're experiencing and be able to address those experiences in a different way. So those underlying emotions, the anxiety, the stress, as mentioned earlier, the guilt and shame, all of that is going to be there and only amplified around family and holidays surrounding food. So slowing down, making decisions for yourself, and do a lot of breathing.
Good advice. I like that. Dr. Lewis Jones, again, site director for the Renfrew Center in West Palm Beach, a treatment facility for those with eating disorders. We also heard from Dr. Autumn Ning, assistant professor of psychodynamic psychiatry at FIU, and Arlene B. Englander, licensed psychotherapist, and her book is called Let Go of Emotional Overeating and Love Your Food, a 5-point plan for success. Again, a really important topic, a very difficult issue, and I know a lot of people struggling with this one. And just to mention, by the way, that you can always go to the National Eating Disorders Helpline, 800-931-2237. Thank you again for sharing your questions with us. Everyone, thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Lewis.
All right. Still to come, we're going to be looking at a new show coming to the Palm Beach Drama Works, making its world debut. That's next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. You know the phrase, liar, liar, pants on fire? You've probably used it yourself a few times. In the world premiere of Lyle Kessler's new play at Palm Beach Drama Works, lies and deceit lead an entire house to catch a blaze. House on Fire is about lies and how they intertwine in our familial relationships. It follows two sets of siblings who have trouble expressing their love, which leads to tons of self-sabotage. Two of the actors in the show, Taylor Anthony Miller and Georgia Warner, and they are joining us now from WXCL in Palm Beach County. They're going to tell us about this show because it's making its world debut in Palm Beach County. Taylor, Georgia, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
All right. First of all, I mean, how do you just, because nobody's seen this show before. So, I mean, it's not like I can say, oh, but it played in Broadway or played over here, played over there. No, this is like new. So how would you describe it to people? Because I probably did not do it justice.
No, I think you actually did it. It was great. I mean, I don't know if we could have said it better ourselves. I mean, it is a play about truth. And, you know, it's basically a brother, Coleman, who is, you know, has been kind of estranged from his family. And he returns after 10 years to find his father may or may not have died. And the brother, who I play, Dale, is there. And it's about them mending their relationship again and just trying to find their sense of family.
Yeah, I think echoing that, that's definitely accurate. And I think sort of what what makes a family. There's a line in the show, what constitutes a family, and whether it's your given family or your, you know, the family you choose to call your family, because as it says in the synopsis, you know, two strangers show up, and I play one of those strangers, that Coleman has been living with or, you know, wandering around with for the last 2 years. And we have decided that he is part of our family, and that sort of search, that sort of, and baseball is a big metaphor in the show, and you know, in baseball you're always trying to get home, so it's, you know, what is home right. is a big part of the show right. too.
Georgia, tell us about your character.
So I play Lane, Zany Lane. She is the sister of Noah. They are both very quirky, interesting characters that, you know, you might not consider conventionally smart, but definitely wise. They sort of, the play has been described as magic realism, and they both possess a lot of intuition and connectivity to, you know, the characters around them in kind of surprising and cool ways. And I think Taylor and I might be performing a little bit of the show here today. So there's a slight spoiler. Now there's a lot of twists and turns in the show. So this won't give away too much. There'll still be plenty of surprises. But a little twist at the end of Act One is that Lane reveals that she is actually pregnant with Coleman's child, who she calls Coleman Toki. That's they don't believe in given names. So.
Oh, well, let's do this because I know I have short time here. You guys are going to do this scene. We're going to keep it at real quick, though, only because I got 90 seconds. But go ahead.
Sure.
And you guys, you're the actors.
Yeah, sure. So just to set up the scene, Coleman does not believe that Lane is pregnant or doesn't want the baby, and he's just stormed out the door. And the sensitive brother Dale, who Taylor plays, has just overheard this exchange. Lane is heartbroken on the couch, and this is where the scene begins.
I believe you.
You believe me?
I'm a light sleeper. I heard you arguing.
We weren't arguing.
What were you doing then?
I don't know what we were doing. I don't have a name for it. All I know is I hurt so badly.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
I thought that he'd be happy. I thought he'd be overjoyed at the news.
I would be.
You would be?
If it was my baby, I'd be more than overjoyed.
Well, it couldn't be your baby because we were never intimate.
Well, I understand.
I mean, we never so much as touch.
Well, I'm extrapolating. That's what writers do.
Well, I don't know much about extrapolating.
I can teach you.
You could teach me how to extrapolate?
It's a wonderful thing. Gives you the freedom not to be in your own skin.
Well, whose skin can you be in?
Doesn't matter. Anybody you want. I mean, is there anybody?
Yeah, there is one person.
And who might that be?
Sonia Henny. She was an ice skater, a figure skater, an Olympic champion. My father worshipped her.
Oh, I've never heard of her.
Oh, well, she was way before our time, or even his time, really. But she was this movie star. He used to watch her old movies on late-night TV.
Did your father ice skate?
Oh, yeah, night and day. He had wonderful grace. Not me. I was terrible on the ice. I couldn't keep my balance. I was no Sonia Henny.
Well, who is?
Well, that's true. Who is?
Oh, this sounds like a trip. It really does. Taylor, real quickly, you're originally from South Florida.
Right.
So
right.
What's it like coming back?
It's great. I love coming down here. My family comes to see the show. I live in New York now, but you know, there's a really vibrant theater scene down here. There's a lot of new plays happening. A lot of playwrights are now having their debuts in New York that were based down here. So it's a real thrill. I mean, there's nothing like performing for your family, doing what you love.
It sounds absolutely fascinating. And I think it's really cool, as you said, that, you know, I mean, this is a show, as we mentioned, that is making it's made its world premiere here in South Florida, and that South Florida is building that scene. And I think that's really great. Again, Taylor Anthony Miller and Georgia Warner, both performers in the new show, House on Fire. It's a production by Lyle Kessler, and it's at the Palm Beach Drama Works until December 30th. They joined us from the studios of WXEL in Palm Beach County. Taylor, Georgia, I really appreciate it. Guys, break a leg.
Thanks, Louise, so much. Hope to see you there.
And that's our program for this Monday, December 17th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.